Okay, we're bringing the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee to order and ask for a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel. Representative Howe.
Present.
Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto. Representative Ward. Representative Zerwas.
Okay, entertain a motion to approve the minutes for March 15th.
So moved.
All right, Representative Frankie moves the minutes for March 15th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carried. And we start off with Representative Erdahl, House File 2119. The Chair will move House File 2119 for layover of possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
We have an amendment, I guess.
Yes, we do.
And the chair will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. To your bill as amended, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, a little history on the disaster assistance account. I've worked on this with Representative Pawlowski over the years, and in 2014, we created a contingency account and statutory appropriation to fund certain disaster relief expenditures, requiring the state to pay the entire non-federal share for local governments of government and American Indian tribes that receive Federal Emergency Management Agency disaster aid, that's FEMA. We also created a new program to provide disaster relief grants to local units of government and American Indian tribes that sustain significant damage but are not eligible for FEMA assistance. Simply put, this applies when there is a governor's declaration of disaster but not a presidential declaration. The account was created with a very minimal appropriation, therefore only local governments were included, not utility cooperatives. In 2015, my bill made utility cooperatives eligible for assistance under a presidential declaration, providing the FEMA match for them. Today, at the request of the Association of Emergency Managers, we've teamed up again with Representative Pawlowski to close the loop and make the utility cooperatives eligible for disaster assistance under a governor's declaration. Under current law, utility co-ops are not eligible for assistance under state disasters declared by the governor. And that's what we'd like to see changed.
Hey, you have a testifier, sir. If you would, is it John Bowen?
Correct.
Would you introduce yourself and begin? Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is John Bowen. I work for the Coyne County Sheriff's Office as the Emergency Management Director. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers to talk about the importance of utility cooperatives being eligible for state disaster for the state disaster assistance account, or 12B. I want to thank Representative Erdahl, Pawlowski, Neuberger, Cornish, Howe, Lilly, and Hamilton for supporting and adding utility cooperatives to the state disaster assistance account. Over the past 2 years, the state of Minnesota has had 11 state disaster declarations. Of the 11 declarations, four of them were in my home county. In 2015, we had the Brainerd Lakes blowdown affecting the Nisqually Gull Lake area. In 2016, we had three more state disaster declarations, two straight-line winds, one flooding event, and this didn't include an EF2 tornado with widespread baseball-sized hail that did not qualify. The storms from the past couple of years have had extreme impact on our local utility cooperatives throughout the state. The past 12 months, the following counties and tribes have had events that met the state disaster declaration: Aiken, Benton, Carlton, Crow Wing, Cass, Clearwater, Mille Lacs, Morrison, Kennebec, Meeker, Pine, Traverse, Itasca, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, Upper Sioux Indian Community, Yellow Medicine, Fond du Lac of Lake Superior, Chippewa, Renville, Wabasha, Blue Earth, Nicollet, and Norman County. As you can see, it has been a very busy year, and this does not include the federal presidential disaster declaration that included nine more counties. The Minnesota Rural Electric Cooperatives support this bill because electric cooperatives should have access to the state disaster funds to help our communities rebuild after natural disasters, just as municipal utilities already have. The legislation has the potential to assist cooperative members significantly by providing much-needed financial help when dealing with devastating natural disasters. Damage to the electrical co-op lines is included in the calculation that triggers FEMA disaster declarations, and we are eligible for federal assistance, but they are not currently eligible to assist for state disaster declarations. Their membership owners are subject to the same risks and costs as municipal utilities and should be eligible for the same treatment. The Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers feels that it is very important to add local utility cooperatives to the state disaster assistance account. The cooperatives are owned and operated by local citizens. It's not if, it's when a disaster strikes. When a disaster strikes, the damages to those cooperatives come back to the community, and impact to the local economy is felt across those counties, the region, and even the state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Member questions? Okay, any comment from the public? Seeing no questions, the chair will renew his motion to lay over for possible inclusion, House File 2119, Representative Overall. Thank you very much, unless you have the last comment.
I don't know if I should bring this up or not, but I think I will because you'll be interested. I mean, there's a fiscal note on it, but my contention is that you can't predict natural disasters. And that was what the same comeback I had 2 years ago on the bill that I had. If you wish, there are folks that can testify as to how this would have no fiscal impact on the state, but perhaps you could do that when you or putting the bill together or whatever.
Sounds good to me. Thank you very much, Representative Erdahl. We'll do it then.
Thank you.
You bet. Okay, Representative Backer, House File 1165. The chair will move House File 1165 to be laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. No amendments, so go ahead, Representative Backer.
Chair, members, this is a pretty straightforward bill. Currently, a farmer is only eligible for legal aid from organizations that provide legal services with a gross income of less than $15,000. So it doesn't matter if that family had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 members in the family. The loss is just $15,000. And what this bill does is it matches it up to the guidelines set by the federal poverty guidelines, and that is eligible of income of 125%. That's all this bill does, is really aligns it with the rest. There is also another provision in the law that says if they have a debt ratio of 50%, they get legal aid. But a lot of times, families who need the help are capped at that $15,000, and that's what this bill does. Really keeps it simple, members.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Backer, I support the concept of this. I think that this is really important to you. I guess that this question is to the chair. Is there going to be a fiscal note on this, or are we going to fund the additional services that legal aid might need to actually do the program? That's the first question. And then the second question is, would legal aid then be eligible to represent someone during, like, a farmer-lender mediation under this bill?
Chair,
Representative Backer.
This did come from that task force. This was their recommendation. So, yes, the bill is really clear. They have this income guideline or this debt-to-ratio guideline they would during that, and this came from that. The fiscal impact is not known yet because obviously we don't know how many people would take advantage of it, and it's a very fair question, but we don't know at this time.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are we requesting a fiscal note? Because one of the challenges that we have is with legal aid currently, even people that are eligible, they can't provide services for everyone who's eligible.
Yep.
And so I just want to make sure that we actually allow them to have the service that then we are saying they're eligible for.
Okay. Mr. Walls, have you any information on that?
Mr. Chair, as Representative Hillstrom stated, there currently are people who are eligible for legal aid who do not receive assistance. This would create another category of eligibility. I did not request a fiscal note because money would not be required under this bill, but would create more people eligible for the same pot of money. Presumably, out of that portion of out of the additional people that would qualify, there still is a fixed pot of money, and there would be more people who could apply for aid and not be served in a given year, but there's not a requirement that any additional funding would have to come from the state.
And they can still turn down people that come to them legally.
Mr. Chair, they're currently turning down people who are eligible and apply. This would create a larger amount of people applying for that limited pot of money.
Any other questions, members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make sure that we have a fine point put on that, that without additional funding then, this means that other people would not receive, that some people would not receive services, or more people who are eligible would not be receiving services with the past. And I definitely do support the bill. I think it's really good. I hope that we're able to increase funding for legal aid to make sure that the people eligible through this are able to receive the services and others as well. Thank you.
Okay. Member questions, public questions? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion for House File 1165 to be held over for possible inclusion on the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair and members. Have a good day.
Representative Frankie, House File 1475, and you can move your own bill once you get to the table. And Representative Frankie, before you begin, I have an amendment to 0124 A17. The amendment, if you get the bill in shape you would like, the chair would move that amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, to your amended bill, Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 1475, what we're doing here is we're creating and establishing a new felony offense for persons who solicit, collect, or provide material support or resources to further an act of terrorism. It establishes a 15-year, 7-year for violating the statute, and that's pretty much it as far as the bill's concerned. The idea comes from, let's just put something on the books for the state of Minnesota. I also have no objection from the County Attorneys Association or the Chiefs Association and the Sheriff's Association. I think this is all just about putting something on the books, a tool in the tool basket that we need to. I would also like to add that with the amendment, when I was shopping this around, I spoke with Representative Pinto and a few others about the concerns of the wording of the bill concerning coercion and how that might affect freedom of speech rights. So in the spirit of bipartisanship, we did add that coercion means compulsion by physical force or threat of physical force. So trying to include everybody in this bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Member questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frankie. I just have a question about line 2.1, so the section 2, influence the policy of a unit of government by intimidation or coercion. What do you envision that would be?
Representative Frank.
I envision it to be just the way the government operates, honestly. Not necessarily the policy. That's where the freedom of speech came in that line. So basically just saying you cannot intimidate or hold our government hostage in any way, shape, or form. That's how I see it.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in the word influence. That's just a very, very broad word, influence. I don't have any issues with any other piece of your bill. I just want to figure out what it is that influenced the policy of a unit of government by intimidation or coercion, what that would be. So, for example, if I came, I think I'm just going to need to get some more clarification before we put this in the bill, just on what that influence word should maybe be.
Do you think Representative Hillstrom,
Representative Hillstrom, I guess I would kind of look at that as, let's say, there's a decision being made at the governmental level, or you're trying to dissuade somebody from making a policy decision, and somebody kidnaps your family, and they're trying to, you know, influence you to make a decision, however favorable that would be for their cause. You know, I guess that would be one instance in how I would see that as how you would try to influence the policy of the government.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that it's those kinds of acts that we're getting at instead of, you know, me saying, if you don't do this, I'm going to sue you, right? That would be trying to coerce you or intimidate you to do something, right? I just want to make sure that we're actually getting at the very acts that we're interested in and not the very acts that sometimes people say in the heat of anger, you know, to influence their government. And so, again, I'm fine with your bill. I just am not sure that influence is the right word that you're looking for based on what you're trying to get at.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. We'll address that here before the bill comes up. Again, Representative Considine, followed by Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're creating a new felony with, it looks like, 15 years in prison. How can there not be a fiscal impact on that?
Mr. Walsh,
Mr. Chair and Representative Considine, the fiscal note in the packet sentencing guideline assumes that there would be extremely rare, if any, cases of prosecution under state law. They would most likely be done by the federal government.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Frankie, and appreciate the clarification on coercion in the amendment. I guess I do share Representative Hillstrom's concern about that line 2.1, and maybe not just the term influence, but also the term intimidation, which I think was what she was getting at in the idea of a lawsuit. Coercion we've got defined here to be physical force, et cetera, but people can be intimidated by something that's not necessarily something physical. And I guess I'm also thinking about situations that that may be intimidating or criminal, but may not be something that we want captured in a bill like this or in this kind of crime. You know, you think about a municipal government, somebody who's, you know, gets angry at their local government about you know, something about, you know, how they're keeping up their home or their yard or that sort of thing, and things can get pretty heated, and you could imagine somebody being pretty intimidating, maybe even being criminally intimidating, but would we necessarily want them penalized in this way? I note that the fiscal note makes reference to the fact that she says under the assumptions there's concern the broad language included in the bill could be interpreted and used for any number of cases not necessarily related to terrorism. So I do support the general concept. I do wonder a little bit about the purpose for this, if there's some gap that needs to be closed, but I appreciate the intent of it in general. But I guess I'm with Representative Hillstrom in terms of that line 2.1 especially. I might want to just connect with you a little bit further on the language to make sure that it's focused. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Frankie will talk to you between now and when the bill comes up again. Any other member questions? Any questions from the public? If not, the chair will renew his motion.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair. I would like to add that I did bring treats.
Oh, good job.
And I was thinking of Representative Neuberger over here when I stopped and picked up Supermoms.
All right.
So,
yeah, Mr. Chair, Supermoms Bakery.
I'll let the record show that I love Supermoms.
Mr. Chair. Representative Frankie in Health and Human Services actually went to the, after he had done so, went and got Jimmy John's and brought him back for the Health and Human Services yesterday. A good member on your side.
Thank you, Representative Frankie, and the chair will move House File 1475 to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Zerwas, House File 1875, you can move your bill once you get there.
Well, this might be the meanest thing all day.
Grab one.
No, I'm good.
Quit fingering them out.
Want to move your bill, Representative Zerwan?
Mr. Chair, members, I will move House File 1875.
For inclusion, possible inclusion.
We'll lay it over for possible inclusion.
Okay, thank you, Representative Zerwas. Your bill is in front of us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 1875 is a bill brought to us in conjunction with the Board of Pharmacy to look at the new course of synthetic drugs that need to be identified in statute as a prohibited controlled substance. I have Cody Weiberg with the Board of Pharmacy here to walk through the bill and answer any questions.
Oh. Go ahead, sir. I think this is something we have done before, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm an executive director of the Board of Pharmacy. We have done this every year for about the last 5 or 6 years, I believe. When the synthetic drug issue first kind of became a really big problem in the state back perhaps in 2007, 2008, the legislature did a couple things. It directed the board, actually there are other reasons for this too, but it directed the board to issue a report every December about anything that we have scheduled by rule, and we also use that report to let the legislature know about new synthetic drugs that have been reported to us by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension or local law enforcement agencies that they are seizing during arrests and identifying. So we come every year, we issue that report, we make recommendations to the legislature about new drugs to add. That's most of this bill. And there are 9 new substances that we have been told about, either by the BCA or law enforcement agencies. Most of these are the controlled substances we've been dealing with for all these years. Stimulants, hallucinogens, and cannabinoids. But there's a very disturbing new trend out there, and that is we're for the first time starting to see synthetic opiates, which are incredibly deadly. And so one of the drugs here is referred to as U47700. That happens to be a synthetic opiate that was found in Prince's system when he overdosed and died. So that's the most of the bill. The other language actually deals with an issue that comes up from time to time where the federal government reschedules a drug and it takes some time to get it rescheduled, either through the rulemaking process or through the legislative process. There's already a provision in there where the board is supposed to, when it's notified about a change in federal scheduling, take certain steps to, actually it basically says the board is supposed to schedule it as the feds have done, unless the board objects. We're proposing some language that streamlines that a little bit, that would automatically similarly schedule the substance under state law until either the board engages in rulemaking or the legislature passes legislation to put a drug in another setting or schedule, excuse me. That's going to be of particular importance in the next year or so because there is a new drug that's on the verge of approval called cannabidiol. It, as the name might imply, it's derived from marijuana, but is completely not psychoactive. It does not produce a high. It is not abusable, but it is very promising in treating some pediatric seizure disorders that are very difficult to treat. That is in Schedule 1 now federally and at the state level. The manufacturer thinks that drug product is going to be approved later this summer or fall. It probably won't even be scheduled federally because it's not psychoactive, but it would be scheduled still in Schedule 1, and it would take some time for the board to engage in rulemaking. So just for that, that's an example of the situation we sometimes run into where literally a product might not be prescribable, if you will, in this state without getting that scheduling done.
Hmm. Representative Neuberger has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Weidberg. These new synthetic opioids that are coming out, are they Narcan reversible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, they can be very difficult. In theory, yes, they can be reversed with Narcan, but it may not be one dose of Narcan, which is usually sufficient for drugs like morphine. It may take several doses of Narcan to reverse the effects of some of these because they're far more potent. And, of course, if a EMT, paramedic, law enforcement officer comes upon someone who's overdosed, they often do not have no idea what this person has taken. They may be waiting for that first dose to take effect when, in fact, it won't. And they may actually assume it's not an opiate because the Narcan's not working.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Any questions from the public? If not, Representative Thurwas, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. I'll renew my motion to lay over House Bill 1875.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Howe, 1892. Representative Howe, you can move your bill once you get to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1892. And where is this going? Is this being held over? Or
yes.
All right.
For possible inclusion.
For possible inclusion. Well, Mr. Chair, this bill's been around the block a couple of times, and it's back. They come back again. And what this does is it amends Section 609.475. to include not only military officers, but also active and reserve component military members and service members and veterans from impersonation. And what this stems from is an incident that happened in Wilmer a few years back where an individual had dressed himself up as a command sergeant major and was receiving free gifts and these types of things, and actually had people believing that he was a retired sergeant major of the Army. And in fact, he had never actually made it all the way through basic training. And this was a Channel 5 investigative report that brought it to my attention. And what we further realized is that there was nothing preventing in a situation of a natural disaster such as a tornado, that type of thing, and we send out the National Guard, there was nothing to prevent someone from dressing up in uniform and passing themselves off as a National Guard member and having people evacuate or telling people they couldn't come into places. So, and we realized that we put not only officers out there to do that, we also put most of our Guard members are probably E4 and below or specialists. They wouldn't even fall into the non-commissioned officer rank. So to put those folks out there, and we have nothing to charge anyone that would falsify that, this would take care of that loophole. I did have a testifier, but I just found out last night he is getting he's getting a brevet promotion to Brigadier General, so he couldn't be here today.
Wow. I don't know what my choice would be.
So that's the bill, and I'll stand for questions.
It reminds me of a friend of mine that was in the Army in Fort Leonard Wood, and he stood up in the back of an M151 Jeep, and his buddy would drive it, and he took a bubble gum or a chewing gum, the silver part of it, the wrapper, and he folded it into a first lieutenant bar, and he put it on his hat. And everybody was saluting him to be at heck when he came down there until he ran into an old salty command sergeant major who noticed it didn't match with his PFC lapel. And he was quite a bit of trouble on that one. So, all right, member questions. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Air Force bases, as I was growing up, there were stickers on the front bumper identifying who was in the car. And my father was a major. And on a number of occasions when I would come through driving the car, the MPs would snap to attention and salute. And then they'd see it was me. And I'd get a dirty look. I'm assuming I would not have been charged with anything.
Representative Powell.
No, that's not the intent, because you did nothing to try to make them actually believe you were the major, your dad. So you wouldn't have been. You just happened to be driving a car, so not there. So that's the biggest part of this. Yeah, they actually have to make the people. The intent is to actually make them believe they are a member of that service.
Okay, member questions? Any other? Any public comment? If none, go ahead and renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion to have the House File 1892 be held over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Powell. Representative Neuberger, House File 1179, and you may move your bill once you get to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a handout here. Paige will send out. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1179. I believe it's for possible inclusion in a later bill. Members, House File 1179 is continuing the good work that we did last session. Currently, there are special teams that respond to emergency situations. One of these types of teams is called an ERT, an emergency response team. They are what you want in your community. Years ago, there used to be four ERTs in Minnesota. That was cut down to one, which is located in St. Paul. Last session, we were able to restore the funding to three of the ERTs, bring them back online. Those ERTs were Duluth, Moorhead, and St. Cloud. An ERT is about 30 people. They are trained to handle whatever happens in these communities. We chose the ERT locations, members, because there was a deficit of coverage in the state that goes along the Burlington Northern the I-94 corridor that would basically go from the metro up to Moorhead. Currently at this time, there's anywhere from 100 to 125 unit trains that travel down that line. We also have all kinds of freight that travels up and down Minnesota Highway 10 and I-94, as I had stated. We have these go through very densely populated areas of our state. Some of our the cities that are included, and when I say dense, I mean condensed in one small geographic area. So when we looked at this, we realized that in this post 9/11 world, and also in the with the energy dynamic that's changing with the Dakotas, it was time to bring the ERTs back on. So we did. This legislature graciously funded it. It was a bipartisan effort, and again, it is a bipartisan effort again this year. I almost filled up the bill with authors and co-authors here from both sides of the aisle. Currently, right now, we're seeking to continue the funding for the Duluth, St. Cloud, and the Moorhead ERTs. I pass to you, all of you, a map of the freight, of where the rail lines are, and then, as you know, the major highways also run real close to those as well. The City of Duluth Fire Chief, Mr. Edwards, was not able to be here today, but he was able to send a letter of support detailing some of the reasons why he would like to continue this. It's signed by himself and his deputy fire chief as well. And with me, I have representation members and Mr. Chair from the fire departments of Moorhead, Minnesota, and St. Cloud. And that's the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Testifier, whichever one would begin, your name and title, and go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dean Roble, the fire chief from the City of St. Cloud Fire Department, and I just want to thank everyone for taking consideration of this bill. The City of St. Cloud is located centrally in the state of Minnesota, and we currently have a CAT team and the emergency response team that respond to throughout the state of Minnesota. We're being centrally located, we can be called upon to respond to almost any part of the state. We have the rail line and U.S. Highway 10 and Interstate 94 running through our jurisdictions, and we also have mutual aid agreements in the central part of the state of Minnesota, which includes Sauk Rapids, Sartell, St. Augusta, St. Joe, Cold Spring, Rockville. And we assist with responding to all of those cities on at least a monthly basis, and then throughout the state on an annual basis. We have a population center that is affected by the oil trains and other hazardous materials that are transported on the freeways and the highways within our jurisdiction. We currently have 60 members, a 60-member fire department, which we have trained to the hazmat technician and specialist level. And that takes an enormous amount of time, effort, and money to support and to continue support. The only training them up initially is one piece, but we have to do continued education every year. And we have had approximately 1,900 hours of training for our fire department in the last year that we have to continue, along with medical evaluations, keeping up with equipment, either buying and replacing and repairing all of that equipment that we carry on our trucks. At this point in time, having this extra money has continued to prepare for any eventual disaster. And even though it seems like we may not respond a lot, but it is awful nice to have well-trained fire department members to respond if there was an emergency. Thank you.
While you're going here, could you address a question here in your testimony of how many times you've actually deployed, and then if you've applied for funding from the fire safety account or other sources?
Yes. The City of St. Cloud emergency response team and CAT team have responded six times in the last calendar year from in 2016, and we do receive funding from the fire safety account for our CAT team in the amount of $60,000. And then we apply for some of our airport rescue fire training, which also assists in training LP-type fires, liquid propane fires, through the HMEP, Hazmat Emergency Preparedness Grant, which is a federal grant through the HSEM.
Okay, thank you, sir. Your name and title, and begin.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Rich Dyson. I'm the fire chief from Moorhead, Minnesota. I wanted to thank everybody for hearing us out on this as well. One of the things about the ERT teams is that we do have similar responsibilities, similar equipment needs, personnel needs, and response needs. And so there is parity between those things. And with Moorhead, I know sometimes we feel like we get forgotten. We're right across the river from Fargo, North Dakota. If anybody ever asks us, where are you from, Moorhead, Minnesota, where is that? Do you know where Fargo is? Everybody knows where Fargo is. But we do have about 105 trains that come through three sets of tracks, about five to six oil trains, and then a whole lot of ag chemicals, anhydrous ammonia, just about every chemical that you can imagine. We also have I-94 and Highway 10 traffic. And one of the things that makes us a little bit unique is that we're 2.5 hours from the nearest chemical assessment team. We also have a chemical assessment team and an ERT, and we cross-staff both of those. We have 30 members that are trained up, or right around 30 members that are trained up to be on the ERT team as well. St. Cloud is our closest CAT team. The other CAT teams are 3 and 4 hours away. So if we had an incident, we would be relying on our mutual aid from Fargo probably first, and then before we could get additional needs met where we're at. If we had a derailment, we could potentially have to evacuate up to 20,000 people if we had to evacuate a mile in all directions. So these teams have been very valuable to us. We've gotten a lot of training out of the funding, and we want to thank you for the funding we have in the past. And my view is that they should be funded equitably, that we should have some parity on that. And then also, I think that this funding would enhance what we already get from the fire safety account to help fund our CAT team. And without reiterating everything that Chief Robel said, I would ditto that. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Considine, a question.
Not a question, Mr. Chair, but we have that assessment from the railroads for safety, $2.5 million that is set to sunset, and this would seem to be a very good use for that money. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm very much in favor of this bill because I have one of the railroad tracks that goes through my community. And I'm glad that the Chief from Moorhead mentioned something besides the Bakken oil trains. The Bakken oil trains don't scare me nearly as much as the other stuff that goes through. Mm-hmm. And that they have what's called the Northern Route that goes from Minneapolis up to Duluth to go across the United States. They keep these most severe chemicals away from Chicago and stuff. They send them across the across northern Wisconsin through my district, and those are the stuff that really scare me. If you want to get scared sometime, sit down along the railroad tracks and read the placards that go through with the book. The oil trains are nothing compared to the other chemicals going through, and I'm glad you guys are trained on that stuff.
Okay, member questions. Any questions from the public? Do you have any more testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Somebody coming up here. Surprise guest. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Cornish and committee members. I'm BJ Jungman. I'm the fire chief from the city of Burnsville. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, which is comprised of four state organizations, the State Fire Chiefs Association, the State Fire Department Association, Fire Marshals Association, and arson investigators. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to talk with Representative Neuberger before this, but as many of you may know, is that there was a study done by MAD earlier this year about the regional response teams, and we have a few concerns about the bill that we feel that we should voice. So as the other testifiers have echoed, we appreciate your support for the fire service and generally appreciate the support you give us and appreciate you taking time for our testimony. Like I said, I'm here to share some concerns about House File 1179, which proposes to fund three of the four emergency response hazmat teams. As I talked about, is HSEM received a final report from MAD in October of 2016 regarding the regional response teams. The report had a number of recommendations within the regional response team study, and HSEM is currently working on implementing those recommendations. The MAD study does recommend only to keep one of the emergency response teams rather than the four that are currently operating. It does recommend keeping those other three at the CAT levels, which they are currently funded at through the fire safety account. The fire safety account currently provides $60,000 to each of those three cities to operate the chemical assessment team. And one other thing to think about is that the ERT teams are inconsistently funded. And the funding beyond the fire safety account ranges anywhere from $75,000 to $225,000. So there's a great inconsistency per team. The wide disparity speaks to the need to ensure that we do additional work to ensure the mission is consistent and effective throughout the state. And within the study, it also talked about the responses. And the 3 years they studied were 2014, 2015, and 2016. And the emergency response teams during that period of time only went outside of their home jurisdiction once in 3 years. And to give a little bit of history prior to the fire safety account, these teams were funded from the general fund. Since the establishment of the fire safety account, the lion's share of costs for these regional response teams has been transferred to the fire safety account. After looking into the current and future operating and capital costs to operate these regional response teams, there's not enough funding to operate all these teams at their current level without additional funding. Many of the capital assets were bought on federal grants following the tragedy of 9/11, and many of those funding sources have dried up. Yet many of the capital assets are or will be due for replacement in the near future. The fire safety account in its current revenue model does not have the resources to fund the operation and capital costs as it currently operates. It should be noted that all the local municipalities assist in funding these regional response teams, as the funding does not completely cover the costs, as you heard from the other two testifiers. The administrative rules governing the hazmat response in the state are antiquated and need to be evaluated as solutions are being sought. For example, the roles and equipment between the chemical assessment team and the emergency response team have become much closer. The majority of the equipment carried by both teams and the training is very similar. We believe a holistic approach is preferred to identify solutions that would modernize the hazardous material response within the state. While we appreciate Representative Neuberger utilizes general fund dollars and is not taking money out of the fire safety account, we would respectfully discourage individual initiatives, as we believe it's more effective to look at the issue holistically. We also believe there's a current process in place through the Fire Safety Advisory Committee, which includes local units of governments to evaluate these types of funding requests and to ensure the efficient use of limited resources that are available. These three teams did not request the emergency response team funding through the fire safety accounts, or Fire Service Advisory Committee, I'm sorry. And as stated at the beginning, the original team funding came from the general fund and was transferred to the fire safety account. Our concern is that legislators may continue to designate their departments as regional or state teams, and that financial burden will be transferred to the fire safety account without input from fire service organizations, local governments, and other state teams and other stakeholders. We have a meeting scheduled later this month within the fire chief's organization to further discuss the issue of regional response teams and the most effective plan moving forward. We're also working with HSCM on the future of all of our state and regional teams. There's a lot of unanswered questions, and I would ask for your support and patience as we look to proceed the most fiscally prudent way while ensuring the effectiveness of the system throughout the state. Thank you for your time and consideration.
How many of these ER teams exist right now?
Four.
Four.
Yep.
What is the overall plan? Have you folks ever talked about as far as how many you want statewide?
So, there, Chair Cornish, there's actually 11 hazmat teams. Four of them are designated as emergency response teams. So there are seven that are at the lower level of chemical assessment team and four that are at the higher level of emergency response team. And the roles of those have kind of become very gray and mixed compared to what the rule 7514, I believe is the rule number, states. And we think that there might be a way to retool this and look at maybe enhancing, and this is just theoretical at this point, but enhancing the chemical assessment team's capabilities and training, and maybe look at reducing the number of ERT teams. I think there's a lot of options out there, and the study points that out.
Representative Neuberger, response to that point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I respect the contrary opinion here. At this time, I did read the MAD report. It was about 125 pages, and what I did note, if you do look at the report, their findings were based on surveys that were conducted within the community itself, within the emergency response community. Of those, there were 11 teams. The CAT teams, there are more CAT teams than there are ERT teams. So it is my opinion that that's why we got a negative, I shouldn't say a negative, but a re-evaluate response from them. But if you put that, rationale beside the current CAT teams, the chemical assessment teams, they're Grand Rapids, Hopkins, International Falls, Mankato, Marshall, Rochester, Blaine, Coon Rapids, and Fridley. All of those, I'm not gonna dissuade any of those because they're good people doing good work, but there's nine people on each one. The ERTs are on the other side of the, pretty much on the other side of the state. These CAT teams would have a difficult time. The closest CAT team to St. Cloud, I'm looking here, would probably be Blaine. The closest CAT team that would be able to come in to help the city of Moorhead, maybe Grand Rapids. If we look at the infrastructures of these cities, that's too much time to wait. An ERT is 30 members, a CAT team is 9. And if you want to pull CAT teams together, you're going to have to wait for them all to arrive on the scene and to coordinate, that's time that you'll never get back in an emergency situation. I speak with some experience on this. I've been on a number of mass casualty incidents throughout my career, and I can tell you time is your most valuable asset, and that's something that we really wouldn't have if there was something, God forbid, happen in northwestern Minnesota or in Duluth. The need is there for the ERTs. I respect the opinion, and I'm glad that the overall fire administration is considering looking into this and reevaluating the problem. But in the here and now, I think it's absolutely essential for us to continue the funding.
Okay, member questions? Questions there? Representative Johnson, and then I see we have another testifier. Go ahead, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newberg, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I do believe we need more than one team. One team located in the metro, they can respond to Oklahoma City faster than they can to Roseau.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem. We need them spaced out throughout the state, because when these situations happen, we don't have 3, 4, 5 hours to wait. A lot of times we need that help long before then. And by having them located throughout the state, it makes better response and better safety to the citizens of Minnesota.
And another testifier.
Good morning. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. Thank you for allowing me to be here to testify. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to speak in favor of Representative Newberg's bill. I thank him for the bill. When we're looking at emergency response, there's two key factors. There's adequate placement of teams, and then there's also adequate resources on those teams. And looking at the number of emergency response teams that we have now, and then putting that next to the MAD study, one thing that we need to realize with the MAD study is that they're looking at existing resources. With the existing resources, there may need to be a reconfiguration of those teams. However, when you look at the numbers from the Minnesota Center of Fiscal Excellence, Minnesota ranks 45th in per capita spending on the fire service. That's 45th in the nation. That's lower than states like Mississippi, lower than states like Arkansas, Alabama. I think that we can do better in a state that's economically as vital and has the vitality as the state of Minnesota. So another concern that I have is the funding, where the funds come from for these teams. In this bill, as is, I'm all for it. The funds coming out of the general fund, when we're looking at taking the funds from the fire safety account or looking at the fire safety account to help beef up the teams, I have concerns. Because when you look at the level of funding in the fire safety account, we have not had a corresponding increase in the level of funding of the fire safety account. And actually, we're kind of hard pressed to have enough funds for the current needs of that account. So I would stress going forward, although that we are in favor of this bill, the MPFF. I do caution against it taking any additional resources out of the fire safety account to pay for additional teams going forward. Thank you.
Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newberg, as I'm listening to the testimony, I would be correct in saying that the vast majority of the threats are due to railroads doing business going through Minnesota.
Yes. What, are you a question, or what was that?
The question is the vast majority of the threats are being generated by the railroads.
Representative Newberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm behaving myself here. A large percentage are of the potential threats that we have would be rail-borne, of course, whether it's oil, anhydrous ammonia, chemicals, or whatnot. But if you look at where these cities are placed, we also have this is just off the top of my head, but I think it would be a pretty safe estimate, probably 30%, at least 30% of the problem is also coming across our roads. So it's not just rail, it's roads as well. When you drive down the highway and you pass the semi with the big, huge tank on the back and you see the placard on the side, we don't know what that is. God help you if it goes off the road. So, and we also have other, we have other resources in the state. I know that in the city of Moorhead, they have large oil storage tanks. I used to live next to them when I was going to college. There are other assets within the state that pose these threats. Is there an issue with the rail? Yes, but it's not the only issue.
Representative Cusby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I'm understanding is that 70% or better, that's why I was suggesting that we might use the assessment that the railroads are currently giving us for safety concerns.
I'm not a big fan of that idea, but that assessment... It's just that was for a specific purpose with a sunset. We would be just continuing it for our own purpose if we did that. So.
And the problem with that is?
Well, the problem with that is that the all of those people that made that agreement was for a specific purpose, not this, and it had a sunset for that reason. And what they wanted to do is just ignore that sunset and keep it in perpetuity, and that's not what the agreement was. So we would be just assessing them again for our own use.
And the safety of the citizens of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
I'm okay with that.
Okay. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Neuberger, just my question comes from my experience with primarily the Coast Guard and then Department of Public Health, having sites around the state to respond to pandemics, to, you know, various other kinds of emergencies. So my question really is, as these three sites and the funding for them are identified here, excuse me, I'm assuming that money for each of these sites includes not just the staff and response time and that sort of thing, but that you need materials to deal with a crisis. You need them stored someplace. You need them to be current so that they're not out of date. Who manages all of that?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to do the phone a friend.
Professor, and introduce yourself once again and begin.
Yes, I'm Dean Roble, the fire chief for the city of St. Cloud. And, yes, we have a lot of equipment. We've got a very large truck and about a 25 to 30-foot trailer that we haul equipment in. We've got everything from the SCBAs, which are the air packs we wear on our backs so we can breathe. We've got chemical-resistant suits. Everybody has turnout gear, which is the firefighting-type gear. We carry monitors, which will monitor the levels of about any chemical imaginable. We do a lot with natural gas. We've got ammonia meters. We've got chlorine meters. So we have all those, which do have a shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
Sensors wear out. The equipment, you know, everybody's got a cell phone or a computer. How often do we replace them? You know, my cell phone, at least my kids anyhow, about every 2 years they need something that's the latest and the greatest, or like mine where it just all of a sudden won't hook up to the system. Same thing happens with the equipment. We've got a lot of computers. We have a lot of programs for computers which do modeling, so if we have a chemical release into the air, we can track where we think it's going to go so we can do evacuations that are methodical and realistic. Instead of just saying we need to evacuate 10 square miles, we can go, okay, we need to go about a half mile on each side of the spill, but we need to go 5 miles downwind from that to make sure that we keep people safe. So to answer your question in a short answer is, yes, there's an awful lot of equipment that we have to do upkeep, that we have to buy. We've got to buy suits and air packs and helmets and fuel and maintenance on all this equipment. So there's a huge expense to that part of it, including not to take away from the training and purchasing of that equipment. So thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify again, the money that you're asking for in this will also cover that renewal, that it's the equipment, and I'm thinking of the chemistry that you need as well, whether it's the foams or whatever. So this money would also cover those material things.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Member questions? Questions from the public. I think we heard everybody. Representative Neuberger, any more?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for your time. This is an excellent program, and it serves our state well, and I would really appreciate your support.
And you can renew your motion.
And I renew my motion to lay this over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you.
Last bill up is mine. House File 2121, I'll move the bill to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. We prepared some comments here for an introduction, and this is the biennial appropriation of the fire safety account revenues. We've done this before. This bill provides an appropriation of $13 million in special revenue funds to this fire safety account for the funding of the State Fire Marshal Division, Minnesota Board of Fire Training and Education Regional Response Team for Minnesota Statute 299F.012. The fire safety account was passed in 2006 and signed into law by Governor Pawlenty. It repealed a hidden tax and replaced it with a dedicated fee to fund three priorities detailed above. The increased service demands on the State Fire Marshal Division staff, critical funding for fire training, and grossly insufficient funding for the state regional response teams drove the effort. Funding for these programs was crucial to enable the continuation of the highly efficient fire service in Minnesota, which ranked 47th per capita household spending, according to the Center for Fiscal Excellence. The State Fire Marshal's Office plays a key role in supporting the 780 fire departments, and only 19 are staffed with career personnel. B.J. Jungman and Chris Parsons are here today to provide additional details and the proposed appropriations which have been worked on at the Fire Service Advisory Committee, which has local governments, the insurance industry, and the fire representation on it. And, sir, you begin introducing yourself, and go ahead.
Chair Cornish, committee members. I'm B.J. Jungman, Fire Chief of the City of Burnsville. Beside me is Mark Rosenblum, the president of the Minnesota Fire Department Association, and next to him is Chris Parsons, the president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association. I want to begin again by thanking you for all your support of the fire service in Minnesota and many initiatives that have come before you. As you likely know, and Chair Cornish just explained a lot about the fire safety account, it's an important funding source to support three essential functions of the fire service: the State Fire Marshal's Office, the Board of Fire Training and Education, and the regional response teams, the hazmat teams, the structural collapse team, and the air rescue team. This fund has accomplished a lot in its 12-year history, and here are some of the examples. It has trained 4,685 new firefighters in the past 4 years with their basic firefighter training. Those firefighters could have went without any training. We still have firefighters in the state of Minnesota that don't have basic firefighter training. It reimbursed 744 out of the 780 fire departments for some of its training since the inception of the program. The State Fire Marshal's Office completed close to 3,000 life safety inspections last year, investigated 425 fires, and completed over 18,000 contact hours of training provided by the Fire Marshal's Office. It enabled all local fire departments to access specialized response teams to respond to numerous technically related incidents, such as hazardous materials, emergencies, or rescue from trench collapses. The fund is overseen by the Fire Service Advisory Committee, which has diverse representation of the stakeholders. The FSAC provides recommendations to the Commissioner of Public Safety on expenses from the fire safety account. This year, the account is expected to have $13 million in revenue, and the proposal in House File 2121 appropriates 12.9 of the $13 million to programs that are established in the statute. That is, in a quick overview, is the State Fire Marshal Division would get $7.0797 million in appropriation. That $1.3 million increase has an increase for salary and benefits, inspections, which allow resources for additional inspections, and $300,000 to cover the cost has been reduced by the federal Medicare and Medicaid centers that pay for inspections in places like the hospital. It appropriates $4.263 million to the Board of Firefighter Training and Education. This will allow us to increase the amount of money going back to each fire department
The goal at the inception of this was to get to $200 per firefighter. This will bring us to just over $100 per firefighter reimbursement for training every year. And it's a $60,000 increase to the Minnesota Air Rescue Team to take care of things like consumables and training, such as fuel for the helicopter. Just for some points of perspective, Chair Corners pointed this out as well, but Minnesota is the 21st most populated, yet we spend 47th out of 50 states on the fire service in total. No other government service is ranked as low in funding within our state, yet it's a critical function and safety service to our communities. We also have the second most volunteer firefighters per capita, and the system continues to struggle with recruitment and retention. We provided a graphic that shows the decision-making process and the participants for the recommendations on the spending from the fire safety account. I'd like to point out that the League of Cities and Association of Townships are also at the table representing local governments. And that graphic I saw many of you looking at is the two-sided colored sheet of paper. I'd ask for your support on this bill as presented to ensure we continue to support the Minnesota Fire Service and the important functions within the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Sir, if your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Chair Cornish. Mark Rosenblum, the President of the State Fire Department Association. I'd just like to add on to what BJ said just a little bit. This is the work that was put forth by the legislature for us to manage the programs that we manage. We've re-edified our requirements and made sure that everything that we are doing fits in the role, fits in the requirements that you guys have set forth for us, and we've done that within the last year to a great extent. We've done some strategic planning, and what I'd like to get across to you is that this does represent things that impact the state statewide. It's not just local. It's not just outstate. It's not just one or another. This goes across the entire state. So these are the programs we believe in. This is what we're supporting, and this is what we had asked for your support on to do continuing. Thank you.
Okay. Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, I'm President of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, Chris Parsons, and I would just like to echo what my two fire service colleagues have just stated. As you can see from the previous bill, we don't necessarily 100% agree on everything, but we do agree on the importance of this account and would greatly appreciate continued support. Thank you.
Okay. Any other testimony? For you folks, any questions from our members? If none, questions from the public. Thank you very much for attending today and give us the information, and the chair will renew his motion for House File 2121 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. And if there's no other questions, meeting adjourned.